General Relativity and the Bucket. Beyond giving the world a mathematically elegant, conceptually powerful, and, for the first time, fully consistent theory of gravity, the general theory of relativity also thoroughly reshaped our view of space and time. In both Newton's conception and that of special relativity, space and time provided an unchanging stage for the events of the universe. Even though the slicing of the cosmos into space at successive moments has a flexibility in special relativity unfathomable in Newton's age, space and time do not respond to happenings in the universe. Space-time, the loaf, as we've been calling it, is taken as a given, once and for all. In general relativity, all this changes. Space and time become players in the evolving cosmos. They come alive. Matter here causes space to warp there, which causes matter over there to move, which causes space way over there to warp even more, and so on. General relativity provides the choreography for an entwined cosmic dance of space, time, matter, and energy. This is a stunning development. But we now come back to our central theme. What about the bucket? Does general relativity provide the physical basis for Mach's relationist ideas, as Einstein hoped it would? Over the years, this question has generated much controversy. Initially, Einstein thought that general relativity fully incorporated Mach's perspective, a viewpoint he considered so important that he christened it Mach's principle. In fact, in 1913, as Einstein was furiously working to put the final pieces of general relativity in place, he wrote Mach an enthusiastic letter in which he described how general relativity would confirm Mach's analysis of Newton's bucket experiment. And in 1918, when Einstein wrote an article enumerating the three essential ideas behind general relativity, the third point in his list was Mach's principle. But general relativity is subtle, and it had features that took many years for physicists, including Einstein himself, to appreciate completely. As these aspects were better understood, Einstein found it increasingly difficult to fully incorporate Mach's principle into general relativity. Little by little, he grew disillusioned with Mach's ideas, and by the later years of his life, came to renounce them. With an additional half-century of research and hindsight, we can consider anew the extent to which general relativity conforms to Mach's reasoning. Although there is still some controversy, I think the most accurate statement is that in some respects general relativity has a distinctly Machian flavor, but it does not conform to the fully relationist perspective Mach advocated. Here's what I mean. Mach argued that when the spinning water's surface becomes concave, or when you feel your arms splay outward, or when the rope tied between the two rocks pulls taut, this has nothing to do with some hypothetical, and in his view thoroughly misguided, notion of absolute space, or absolute space-time, in our more modern understanding. Instead, he argued that it's evidence of accelerated motion with respect to all the matter that's spread throughout the cosmos. Were there no matter, there'd be no notion of acceleration, and none of the enumerated physical effects, concave water, splaying arms, rope pulling taut, would happen. What does general relativity say? According to general relativity, the benchmarks for all motion, and accelerated motion in particular, are freely falling observers. Observers who have fully given in to gravity and are being acted on by no other forces. Now, a key point is that the gravitational force to which a freely falling observer acquiesces arises from all the matter and energy spread throughout the cosmos. The Earth, The moon, the distant planets, stars, gas clouds, quasars, and galaxies all contribute to the gravitational field. In geometrical language, to the curvature of space-time, right where you're now sitting. Things that are more massive and less distant exert a greater gravitational influence, but the gravitational field you feel represents the combined influence of the matter that's out there. The path you'd take, were you to give in to gravity fully and assume free-fall motion, the benchmark you'd become for judging whether some other object is accelerating, would be influenced by all matter in the cosmos, by the stars in the heavens, and by the house next door. Thus, in general relativity, when an object is said to be accelerating, it means the object is accelerating with respect to a benchmark determined by matter spread throughout the universe. That's a conclusion which has the feel of what Mach advocated. So, in this sense, general relativity does incorporate some of Mach's thinking. Nevertheless, general relativity does not confirm all of Mach's reasoning, as we can see directly by considering, once again, the spinning bucket in an otherwise empty universe. In an empty, unchanging universe, no stars, no planets, no anything at all, there is no gravity. And without gravity, space-time is not warped. It takes a simple, uncurved shape. And that means we are back in the simpler setting of special relativity. Remember, Einstein ignored gravity while developing special relativity. General relativity made up for this deficiency by incorporating gravity. But when the universe is empty and unchanging, there is no gravity. And so general relativity reduces to special relativity. If we now introduce the bucket into this empty universe, it has such a tiny mass that its presence hardly affects the shape of space at all. And so the discussion we had earlier for the bucket in special relativity applies equally well to general relativity. In contradiction to what Mach would have predicted, general relativity comes to the same answer as special relativity, and proclaims that even in an otherwise empty universe, you will feel pressed against the inner wall of the spinning bucket. In an otherwise empty universe, your arms will feel pulled outward if you spin around. In an otherwise empty universe, the rope tied between two twirling rocks will become taut. The conclusion we draw is that even in general relativity, empty space-time provides a benchmark for accelerated motion. Hence, although general relativity incorporates some elements of Mach's thinking, it does not subscribe to the completely relative conception of motion Mach advocated. Mach's principle is an example of a provocative idea that provided inspiration for a revolutionary discovery, even though that discovery ultimately failed to fully embrace the idea that inspired it. Space-time in the third millennium. The spinning bucket has had a long run, from Newton's absolute space and absolute time, to Leibniz's and then Mach's relational conceptions, to Einstein's realization in special relativity that space and time are relative, and yet in their union fill out absolute space-time, to his subsequent discovery in general relativity that space-time is a dynamic player in the unfolding cosmos. The bucket has always been there. Twirling in the back of the mind, it has provided a simple and quiet test for whether the invisible, the abstract, the untouchable stuff of space, and space-time more generally, is substantial enough to provide the ultimate reference for motion. The verdict? Although the issue is still debated, as we've now seen, the most straightforward reading of Einstein and his general relativity is that space-time can provide such a benchmark. Space-time is a something. Notice, though, that this conclusion is also cause for celebration among supporters of a more broadly defined relationist outlook. In Newton's view, and also that of special relativity, Space and space-time were invoked as entities that provide the reference for defining accelerated motion. And since, according to these perspectives, space and space-time are absolutely unchangeable, this notion of acceleration is absolute. In general relativity, though, the character of space-time is completely different. Space and time are dynamic in general relativity. They are mutable. They respond to the presence of mass and energy. They are not absolute. Space-time, and in particular the way it warps and curves, is an embodiment of the gravitational field. Thus, in general relativity, acceleration relative to space-time is a far cry from the absolute, staunchly unrelational conception invoked by previous theories. Instead, as Einstein argued eloquently a few years before he died, acceleration relative to general relativity's space-time is relational. It is not acceleration relative to material objects like stones or stars, but it is acceleration relative to something just as real, tangible, and changeable. A field. The gravitational field. In this sense, space-time, by being the incarnation of gravity, is so real in general relativity that the benchmark it provides is one that many relationists can comfortably accept. Debate on the issues discussed in this chapter will no doubt continue as we grope to understand what space, time, and space-time actually are. With the development of quantum mechanics, the plot only thickens. The concepts of empty space and of nothingness take on a whole new meaning when quantum uncertainty takes the stage. Indeed, since 1905, when Einstein did away with the luminiferous ether, the idea that space is filled with invisible substances has waged a vigorous comeback. As we will see in later chapters, key developments in modern physics have reinstituted various forms of an ether-like entity, none of which set an absolute standard for motion like the original luminiferous ether, but all of which thoroughly challenged the naive conception of what it means for space-time to be empty. Moreover, as we will now see, the most basic role that space plays in a classical universe, as the medium that separates one object from another, as the intervening stuff that allows us to declare definitively that one object is distinct and independent from another, is thoroughly challenged by startling quantum connections. Chapter 4. Entangling Space. What does it mean to be separate in a quantum universe? To accept special and general relativity is to abandon Newtonian absolute space and absolute time. While it's not easy, you can train your mind to do this. Whenever you move around, imagine your now shifting away from the nows experienced by all others not moving with you. While you are driving along a highway, imagine your watch ticking away at a different rate compared with timepieces in the homes you are speeding past. While you are gazing out from a mountaintop, imagine that because of the warping of space-time, time passes more quickly for you than for those subject to stronger gravity on the ground far below. I say imagine because in ordinary circumstances such as these, the effects of relativity are so tiny that they go completely unnoticed. Everyday experience thus fails to reveal how the universe really works. And that's why, 100 years after Einstein, almost no one, not even professional physicists, feels relativity in their bones. This isn't surprising. One is hard-pressed to find the survival advantage offered by a solid grasp of relativity. Newton's flawed conception of absolute space and absolute time work wonderfully well at the slow speeds and moderate gravity we encounter in daily life. So our senses are under no evolutionary pressure to develop relativistic acumen. Deep awareness and true understanding, therefore, require that we diligently use our intellect to fill in the gaps left by our senses. While relativity represented a monumental break with traditional ideas about the universe, between 1900 and 1930, another revolution was also turning physics upside down. It started at the turn of the 20th century with a couple of papers on properties of radiation, one by Max Planck and the other by Einstein. These, after three decades of intense research, led to the formulation of quantum mechanics. As with relativity, whose effects become significant under extremes of speed or gravity, the new physics of quantum mechanics reveals itself abundantly only in another extreme situation, the realm of the extremely tiny. But there is a sharp distinction between the upheavals of relativity and those of quantum mechanics. The weirdness of relativity arises because our personal experience of space and time differs from the experience of others. It is a weirdness born of comparison. We are forced to concede that our view of reality is but one among many, an infinite number, in fact, which all fit together within the seamless whole of space-time. Quantum mechanics is different. Its weirdness is evident without comparison. It is harder to train your mind to have quantum mechanical intuition because quantum mechanics shatters our own personal, individual conception of reality.
The world according to the quantum.
Every age develops its stories or metaphors for how the universe was conceived and structured. According to an ancient Indian creation myth, the universe was created when the gods dismembered the primordial giant Purusha, whose head became the sky, whose feet became the earth, and whose breath became the wind. To Aristotle, the universe was a collection of 55 concentric crystalline spheres, the outermost being heaven, surrounding those of the planets, earth and its elements, and finally the seven circles of hell. With Newton and his precise, deterministic mathematical formulation of motion, the description changed again. The universe was likened to the ticking of an enormous, grand clockwork. After being wound and set into its initial state, the clockwork universe ticks from one moment to the next with complete regularity and predictability. Special and general relativity pointed out important subtleties of the clockwork metaphor. There is no single, preferred, universal clock. There is no consensus on what constitutes a moment, what constitutes a now. Even so, you can still tell a clockwork-like story about the evolving universe. The clock is your clock. The story is your story. But the universe unfolds with the same regularity and predictability as in the Newtonian framework. If, by some means, you know the state of the universe right now, if you know where every particle is and how fast and in what direction each is moving, then, Newton and Einstein agree, you can, in principle, use the laws of physics to predict everything about the universe arbitrarily far into the future, or to figure out what it was like arbitrarily far into the past. Quantum mechanics breaks with this tradition. We can't ever know the exact location and exact velocity of even a single particle. We can't predict with total certainty the outcome of even the simplest of experiments, let alone the evolution of the entire cosmos. Quantum mechanics shows that the best we can ever do is predict the probability that an experiment will turn out this way or that. And as quantum mechanics has been verified through decades of fantastically accurate experiments, the Newtonian cosmic clock, even with its Einsteinian updating, is an untenable metaphor. It is demonstrably not how the world works. But the break with the past is yet more complete. Even though Newton's and Einstein's theories differ sharply on the nature of space and time, they do agree on certain basic facts, certain truths that appear to be self-evident. If there is space between two objects, if there are two birds in the sky, and one is way off to your right and the other is way off to your left, we can and do consider the two objects to be independent. We regard them as separate and distinct entities. Space, whatever it is fundamentally, provides the medium that separates and distinguishes one object from another. That is what space does. Things occupying different locations in space are different things. Moreover, in order for one object to influence another, it must, in some way, negotiate the space that separates them. One bird can fly to the other, traversing the space between them, and then peck or nudge its companion. One person can influence another by shooting a slingshot, causing a pebble to traverse the space between them, or by yelling, causing a domino effect of bouncing air molecules, one jostling the next until some bang into the recipient's eardrum. Being yet more sophisticated, one can exert influence on another by firing a laser, causing an electromagnetic wave, a beam of light, to traverse the intervening space. Or, being more ambitious, like the extraterrestrial pranksters of last chapter, one can shake or move a massive body, like the moon, sending a gravitational disturbance speeding from one location to another. To be sure, if we are over here, we can influence someone over there. But no matter how we do it, the procedure always involves someone or something traveling from here to there. And only when the someone or something gets there can the influence be exerted. Physicists call this feature of the universe locality, emphasizing the point that you can directly affect only things that are next to you, that are local. Voodoo contravenes locality, since it involves doing something over here and affecting something over there without the need for anything to travel from here to there. But common experience leads us to think that verifiable, repeatable experiments would confirm locality. And most do. But a class of experiments performed during the last couple of decades has shown that something we do over here, such as measuring certain properties of a particle, can be subtly entwined with something that happens over there, such as the outcome of measuring certain properties of another distant particle, without anything being sent from here to there. While intuitively baffling, this phenomenon fully conforms to the laws of quantum mechanics, and was predicted using quantum mechanics long before the technology existed to do the experiment, and observe, remarkably, that the prediction is correct. This sounds like voodoo. Einstein, who was among the first physicists to recognize, and sharply criticize, this possible feature of quantum mechanics, called it spooky. But as we shall see, the long-distance links these experiments confirm are extremely delicate and are, in a precise sense, fundamentally beyond our ability to control. Nevertheless, these results, coming from both theoretical and experimental considerations, strongly support the conclusion that the universe admits interconnections that are not local. Something that happens over here can be entwined with something that happens over there, even if nothing travels from here to there. And even if there isn't enough time for anything, even light, to travel between the events. This means that space cannot be thought of as it once was. Rather, intervening space, regardless of how much there is, does not ensure that two objects are separate, since quantum mechanics allows an entanglement, a kind of connection, to exist between them. A particle, like one of the countless number that make up you or me, can run, but it can't hide. According to quantum theory and the many experiments that bear out its predictions, the quantum connection between two particles can persist even if they are on opposite sides of the universe. From the standpoint of their entanglement, notwithstanding the many trillions of miles of space between them, it's as if they are right on top of each other. Numerous assaults on our conception of reality are emerging from modern physics. We will encounter many in the following chapters. But of those that have been experimentally verified, I find none more mind-boggling than the recent realization that our universe is not local. The Red and the Blue. To get a feel for the kind of non-locality emerging from quantum mechanics, imagine that Agent Scully, long overdue for a vacation, retreats to her family's estate in Provence. Before she's had time to unpack, the phone rings. It's Agent Mulder calling from America. "Did you get the box, the one wrapped in red and blue paper?" Scully, who has dumped all her mail in a pile by the door, looks over and sees the package. "Mulder, please, I didn't come all the way to X just to deal with another stack of files." "No, no, the package is not from me. I got one, too. And inside there are these little light-proof titanium boxes numbered from 1 to 1,000, and a letter saying that you would be receiving an identical package." "Yes, so?" Scully slowly responds, beginning to fear that the titanium boxes may somehow wind up cutting her vacation short. "Well," Mulder continues, "the letter says that each titanium box contains an alien sphere that will flash red or blue the moment the little door on its side is opened." "Mulder, am I supposed to be impressed?" "Well, not yet, but listen. The letter says that before any given box is opened, the sphere has the capacity to flash either red or blue, and it randomly decides between the two colors at the moment the door is opened. But here's the strange part. The letter says that although your boxes work exactly the same as mine, even though the spheres inside each one of our boxes randomly choose between flashing red or blue, our boxes somehow work in tandem. The letter claims that there is a mysterious connection, so that if there is a blue flash when I open my box one, you will also find a blue flash when you open your box one. If I see a red flash when I open box two, you will also see a red flash in your box two, and so on."
"Mulder, I'm really exhausted. Let's let the parlor tricks wait till I get back."
"Scully, please. I know you're on vacation, but we can't just let this go. We'll only need a few minutes to see if it's true." Reluctantly, Scully realizes that resistance is futile. So she goes along and opens her little boxes. And on comparing the colors that flash inside each box, Scully and Mulder do indeed find the agreement predicted in the letter. Sometimes the sphere in a box flashes red, sometimes blue. But on opening boxes with the same number, Scully and Mulder always see the same color flash. Mulder grows increasingly excited and agitated by the alien spheres, but Scully is thoroughly unimpressed.
"Mulder," Scully sternly says into the phone, "you really need a vacation. This is silly. Obviously, the sphere inside each of our boxes has been programmed to flash red, or it has been programmed to flash blue when the door to its box is opened. And whoever sent us this nonsense programmed our boxes identically so that you and I find the same color flash in boxes with the same number."
"But no, Scully, the letter says each alien sphere randomly chooses between flashing blue and red when the door is opened, not that the sphere has been pre-programmed to choose one color or the other."
"Mulder," Scully sighs, "my explanation makes perfect sense, and it fits all the data. What more do you want? And look here at the bottom of the letter. Here's the biggest laugh of all. The alien small print informs us that not only will opening the door to a box cause the sphere inside to flash, but any other tampering with the box to figure out how it works, for example, if we try to examine the sphere's color composition or chemical makeup before the door is opened, will also cause it to flash. In other words, we can't analyze the supposed random selection of red or blue because any such attempt will contaminate the very experiment we are trying to carry out. It's as if I told you I'm really a blonde, but I become a redhead whenever you or anyone or anything looks at my hair or analyzes it in any way. How could you ever prove me wrong?
Your tiny green men are pretty clever. They've set things up so their ruse can't be unmasked.
Now, go and play with your little boxes while I enjoy a little peace and quiet.
It would seem that Scully has this one soundly wrapped up on the side of science.
Yet, here's the thing.
Quantum mechanicians, scientists, not aliens, have for nearly 80 years been making claims about how the universe works that closely parallel those described in the letter. The rub is that there is now strong scientific evidence that a viewpoint along the lines of Mulder's, not Scully's, is supported by the data. For instance, according to quantum mechanics, a particle can hang in a state of limbo between having one or another particular property, like an alien sphere hovering between flashing red and flashing blue before the door to its box is opened. And only when the particle is looked at, measured, does it randomly commit to one definite property or another. As if this weren't strange enough, quantum mechanics also predicts that there can be connections between particles, similar to those claimed to exist between the alien spheres. Two particles can be so entwined by quantum effects that their random selection of one property or another is correlated, just as each of the alien spheres chooses randomly between red and blue, and yet somehow the colors chosen by spheres in boxes with the same number are correlated, both flashing red or both flashing blue. The properties chosen randomly by two particles, even if they are far apart in space, can similarly be aligned perfectly. Roughly speaking, even though the two particles are widely separated, quantum mechanics shows that whatever one particle does, the other will do too. As a concrete example, if you are wearing a pair of sunglasses, quantum mechanics shows that there is a 50-50 chance that a particular photon, like one that is reflected toward you from the surface of a lake or from an asphalt roadway, will make it through your glare-reducing polarized lenses. When the photon hits the glass, it randomly chooses between reflecting back and passing through. The astounding thing is that such a photon can have a partner photon that has sped miles away in the opposite direction. And yet, when confronted with the same 50-50 probability of passing through another polarized sunglass lens, will somehow do whatever the initial photon does. Even though each outcome is determined randomly, and even though the photons are far apart in space, if one photon passes through, so will the other. This is the kind of non-locality predicted by quantum mechanics. Einstein, who was never a great fan of quantum mechanics, was loath to accept that the universe operated according to such bizarre rules. He championed more conventional explanations that did away with the notion that particles randomly select attributes and outcomes when measured. Instead, Einstein argued that if two widely separated particles are observed to share certain attributes, this is not evidence of some mysterious quantum connection instantaneously correlating their properties. Rather, just as Scully argued that the spheres do not randomly choose between red and blue, but instead are programmed to flash one particular color when observed, Einstein claimed that particles do not randomly choose between having one feature or another, but instead are similarly programmed to have one particular definite feature when suitably measured. The correlation between the behavior of widely separated photons is evidence, Einstein claimed, that the photons were endowed with identical properties when emitted, not that they are subject to some bizarre long-distance quantum entanglement. For close to 5 decades, the issue of who was right, Einstein or the supporters of quantum mechanics, was left unresolved because, as we shall see, the debate became much like that between Scully and Mulder. Any attempt to disprove the proposed strange quantum mechanical connections and leave intact Einstein's more conventional view ran afoul of the claim that the experiments themselves would necessarily contaminate the very features they were trying to study.
All this changed in the 1960s. With a stunning insight, the Irish physicist John Bell showed that the issue could be settled experimentally. And by the 1980s it was. The most straightforward reading of the data is that Einstein was wrong, and there can be strange, weird, and spooky quantum connections between things over here and things over there. The reasoning behind this conclusion is so subtle that it took physicists more than 3 decades to appreciate fully. But after covering the essential features of quantum mechanics, we will see that the core of the argument reduces to nothing more complex than a click-and-clack puzzler. Casting a wave. If you shine a laser pointer on a little piece of black, overexposed 35mm film, from which you have scratched away the emulsion in 2 extremely close and narrow lines, you will see direct evidence that light is a wave. If you've never done this, it's worth a try. You can use many things in place of the film, such as the wire mesh in a fancy coffee plunger. The image you will see when the laser light passes through the slits on the film and hits a screen consists of light and dark bands, and the explanation for this pattern relies on a basic feature of waves. Water waves are easiest to visualize, so let's first explain the essential point with waves on a large, placid lake, and then apply our understanding to light. A water wave disturbs the flat surface of a lake by creating regions where the water level is higher than usual and regions where it is lower than usual. The highest part of a wave is called its peak, and the lowest part is called its trough. A typical wave involves a periodic succession. Peak followed by trough, followed by peak, and so forth. If two waves head toward each other, if, for example, you and I each drop a pebble into the lake at nearby locations, producing outward-moving waves that run into each other, when they cross, there results an important effect known as interference. When a peak of one wave and a peak of the other cross, the height of the water is even greater, being the sum of the two peak heights. Similarly, when a trough of one wave and a trough of the other cross, the depression in the water is even deeper, being the sum of the two depressions. And here is the most important combination. When a peak of one wave crosses the trough of another, they tend to cancel each other out, as the peak tries to make the water go up, while the trough tries to drag it down. If the height of one wave's peak equals the depth of the other's trough, there will be perfect cancellation when they cross, so the water at that location will not move at all. The same principle explains the pattern that light forms when it passes through the two slits. Light is an electromagnetic wave. When it passes through the two slits, it splits into two waves that head toward the screen. Like the two water waves just discussed, the two light waves interfere with each other. When they hit various points on the screen, sometimes both waves are at their peaks, making the screen bright. Sometimes both waves are at their troughs, also making it bright. But sometimes one wave is at its peak and the other is at its trough, and they cancel, making that point on the screen dark. When the wave motion is analyzed in mathematical detail, including the cases of partial cancellations between waves at various stages between peaks and troughs, one can show that the bright and dark spots fill out the bands. The bright and dark bands are therefore a telltale sign that light is a wave, an issue that had been hotly debated ever since Newton claimed that light is not a wave, but instead is made up of a stream of particles. More on this in a moment. Moreover, this analysis applies equally well to any kind of wave. Light wave, water wave, sound wave, you name it. And thus interference patterns provide the metaphorical smoking gun. You know you are dealing with a wave if, when it is forced to pass through two slits of the right size, determined by the distance between the wave's peaks and troughs, the resulting intensity pattern consists of bright regions representing high intensity and dark regions low intensity. In 1927, Clinton Davison and Lester Germer fired a beam of electrons, particulate entities without any apparent connection to waves, at a piece of nickel crystal. The details need not concern us, but what does matter is that this experiment is equivalent to firing a beam of electrons at a barrier with two slits. When the experimenters allowed the electrons that passed through the slits to travel onward to a phosphor screen, where their impact location was recorded by a tiny flash, the same kind of flashes responsible for the picture on your television screen, the results were astonishing. Thinking of the electrons as little pellets or bullets, you'd naturally expect their impact positions to line up with the two slits. But that's not what Davison and Germer found. Their experiment produced data indicating that the electron impact positions filled out an interference pattern characteristic of waves. Davison and Germer had found the smoking gun. They had shown that the beam of particulate electrons must, unexpectedly, be some kind of wave. Now, you might not think this is particularly surprising. Water is made of H2O molecules, and a water wave arises when many molecules move in a coordinated pattern. One group of H2O molecules goes up in one location, while another group goes down in a nearby location. Perhaps the data show that electrons, like H2O molecules, sometimes move in concert, creating a wave-like pattern in their overall macroscopic motion. While at first blush this might seem to be a reasonable suggestion, the actual story is far more unexpected. We initially imagined that a flood of electrons was fired continuously from the electron gun. But we can tune the gun so that it fires fewer and fewer electrons every second. In fact, we can tune it all the way down so that it fires, say, only one electron every 10 seconds. With enough patience, we can run this experiment over a long period of time and record the impact position of each individual electron that passes through the slits, showing the resulting cumulative data after an hour, half a day, and a full day. In the 1920s, these and similar images rocked the foundations of physics. We see that even individual particulate electrons, moving to the screen independently, separately, one by one, build up the interference pattern characteristic of waves. This is as if an individual H2O molecule could still embody something akin to a water wave. But how in the world could that be? Wave motion seems to be a collective property that has no meaning when applied to separate particulate ingredients. If every few minutes individual spectators in the bleachers get up and sit down separately, independently, they are not doing the wave. More than that, wave interference seems to require a wave from here to cross a wave from there. So how can interference be at all relevant to single, individual, particulate ingredients? But somehow, as attested by the interference data, even though individual electrons are tiny particles of matter, each and every one also embodies a wave-like character. Probability and the laws of physics. If an individual electron is also a wave, what is it that is waving? Erwin Schrödinger weighed in with the first guess. Maybe the stuff of which electrons are made can be smeared out in space, and it's this smeared electron essence that does the waving. An electron particle, from this point of view, would be a sharp spike in an electron mist. It was quickly realized, though, that this suggestion couldn't be correct, because even a sharply spiked wave shape, such as a giant tidal wave, ultimately spreads out. And if the spiked electron wave were to spread, we would expect to find part of a single electron's electric charge over here, or part of its mass over there. But we never do. When we locate an electron, we always find all of its mass and all of its charge concentrated in one tiny, point-like region. In 1927, Max Born put forward a different suggestion, one that turned out to be the decisive step that forced physics to enter a radically new realm. The wave, he claimed, is not a smeared-out electron, nor is it anything ever previously encountered in science. The wave, Born proposed, is a probability wave. To understand what this means, picture a snapshot of a water wave that shows regions of high intensity, near the peaks and troughs, and regions of low intensity, near the flatter transition regions between peaks and troughs. The higher the intensity, the greater the potential the water wave has for exerting force on nearby ships or on coastline structures. The probability waves envisioned by Born also have regions of high and low intensity, but the meaning he ascribed to these wave shapes was unexpected. The size of a wave at a given point in space is proportional to the probability that the electron is located at that point in space. Places where the probability wave is large are locations where the electron is most likely to be found. Places where the probability wave is small are locations where the electron is unlikely to be found. And places where the probability wave is zero are locations where the electron will not be found. A snapshot of a probability wave would resemble several mountain peaks of various heights piercing a layer of fog, with labels, most likely, next most likely, and third most likely location, emphasizing Born's probabilistic interpretation. Unlike a photograph of water waves, though, this image could not actually have been made with a camera. No one has ever directly seen a probability wave, and conventional quantum mechanical reasoning says that no one ever will. Instead, we use mathematical equations, developed by Schrödinger, Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, Paul Dirac, and others, to figure out what the probability wave should look like in a given situation. We then test such theoretical calculations by comparing them with experimental results in the following way. After calculating the purported probability wave for the electron in a given experimental setup, we carry out identical versions of the experiment over and over again from scratch, each time recording the measured position of the electron. In contrast to what Newton would have expected, identical experiments and starting conditions do not necessarily lead to identical measurements. Instead, our measurements yield a variety of measured locations. Sometimes we find the electron here, sometimes there, and every so often we find it way over there. If quantum mechanics is right, the number of times we find the electron at a given point should be proportional to the size, actually the square of the size, at that point, of the probability wave that we calculated. 8 decades of experiments have shown that the predictions of quantum mechanics are confirmed to spectacular precision. According to quantum mechanics, every probability wave extends throughout all of space, throughout the entire universe. In many circumstances, though, a particle's probability wave quickly drops very close to zero outside some small region, indicating the overwhelming likelihood that the particle is in that region. In such cases, the part of the probability wave extending throughout the rest of the universe looks quite flat and near the value zero. Nevertheless, so long as the probability wave somewhere in the Andromeda galaxy has a non-zero value, no matter how small, there is a tiny but genuine, non-zero chance that the electron could be found there. Thus, the success of quantum mechanics forces us to accept that the electron, a constituent of matter that we normally envision as occupying a tiny, point-like region of space, also has a description involving a wave that, to the contrary, is spread through the entire universe. Moreover, according to quantum mechanics, this particle wave fusion holds for all of nature's constituents, not just electrons. Protons are both particle-like and wave-like. Neutrons are both particle-like and wave-like. And experiments in the early 1900s even established that light, which demonstrably behaves like a wave, can also be described in terms of particulate ingredients, the little bundles of light called photons mentioned earlier. The familiar electromagnetic waves emitted by a 100-watt bulb, for example, can equally well be described in terms of the bulbs emitting about 100 billion photons each second. In the quantum world, we've learned that everything has both particle-like and wave-like attributes. Over the last 8 decades, the ubiquity and utility of quantum mechanical probability waves to predict and explain experimental results has been established beyond any doubt. Yet there is still no universally agreed-upon way to envision what quantum mechanical probability waves actually are. Whether we should say that an electron's probability wave is the electron, or that it's associated with the electron, or that it's a mathematical device for describing the electron's motion, or that it's the embodiment of what we can know about the electron, is still debated. What is clear, though, is that through these waves, quantum mechanics injects probability into the laws of physics in a manner that no one had anticipated. Meteorologists use probability to predict the likelihood of rain. Casinos use probability to predict the likelihood you'll throw snake eyes. But probability plays a role in these examples because we haven't all of the information necessary to make definitive predictions. According to Newton, if we knew in complete detail the state of the environment, the positions and velocities of every one of its particulate ingredients, we would be able to predict, given sufficient calculational prowess, with certainty, whether it will rain at 4:07 p.m. tomorrow. If we knew all the physical details of relevance to a craps game, the precise shape and composition of the dice, their speed and orientation as they left your hand, the composition of the table and its surface, and so on, we would be able to predict with certainty how the dice will land. Since, in practice, we can't gather all this information, and even if we could, we do not yet have sufficiently powerful computers to perform the calculations required to make such predictions. We set our sights lower and predict only the probability of a given outcome in the weather or at the casino, making reasonable guesses about the data we don't have. The probability introduced by quantum mechanics is of a different, more fundamental character. Regardless of improvements in data collection or in computer power, the best we can ever do, according to quantum mechanics, is predict the probability of this or that outcome. The best we can ever do is predict the probability that an electron, or a proton, or a neutron, or any other of nature's constituents, will be found here or there. Probability reigns supreme in the microcosmos. As an example, the explanation quantum mechanics gives for individual electrons, one by one, over time, building up the pattern of light and dark bands, is now clear. Each individual electron is described by its probability wave. When an electron is fired, its probability wave flows through both slits. And, just as with light waves and water waves, the probability waves emanating from the two slits interfere with each other. At some points on the detector screen, the two probability waves reinforce and the resulting intensity is large. At other points, the waves partially cancel and the intensity is small. At still other points, the peaks and troughs of the probability waves completely cancel and the resulting wave intensity is exactly zero. That is, there are points on the screen where it is very likely an electron will land, points where it is far less likely that it will land, and places where there is no chance at all that an electron will land. Over time, the electron's landing positions are distributed according to this probability profile, and hence we get some bright, some dimmer, and some completely dark regions on the screen. Einstein and quantum mechanics. Because of its inherently probabilistic nature, quantum mechanics differs sharply from any previous fundamental description of the universe, qualitative or quantitative. Since its inception last century, physicists have struggled to mesh this strange and unexpected framework with the common worldview. The struggle is still very much underway. The problem lies in reconciling the macroscopic experience of day-to-day life with the microscopic reality revealed by quantum mechanics. We are used to living in a world that, while admittedly subject to the vagaries of economic or political happenstance, appears stable and reliable at least as far as its physical properties are concerned. You do not worry that the atomic constituents of the air you are now breathing will suddenly disband, leaving you gasping for breath as they manifest their quantum wave-like character by rematerializing willy-nilly on the dark side of the moon. And you are right not to fret about this outcome, because according to quantum mechanics, the probability of its happening, while not zero, is absurdly small. But what makes the probability so small? Roughly speaking, there are two reasons. First, on a scale set by atoms, the moon is enormously far away. And, as mentioned, in many circumstances, although by no means all, the quantum equations show that a probability wave typically has an appreciable value in some small region of space and quickly drops nearly to zero as you move away from this region. So the likelihood that even a single electron that you expect to be in the same room as you, such as one of those that you just exhaled, will be found in a moment or two on the dark side of the moon, while not zero, is extremely small. So small that it makes the probability that you will marry Nicole Kidman or Antonio Banderas seem enormous by comparison. Second, there are a lot of electrons, as well as protons and neutrons, making up the air in your room. The likelihood that all of these particles will do what is extremely unlikely even for one is so small that it's hardly worth a moment's thought. It would be like not only marrying your movie star heartthrob, but then also winning every state lottery every week for, well, a length of time that would make the current age of the universe seem a mere cosmic flicker. This gives some sense of why we do not directly encounter the probabilistic aspects of quantum mechanics in day-to-day life. Nevertheless, because experiments confirm that quantum mechanics does describe fundamental physics, it presents a frontal assault on our basic beliefs as to what constitutes reality. Einstein, in particular, was deeply troubled by the probabilistic character of quantum theory. Physics, he would emphasize again and again, is in the business of determining with certainty what has happened, what is happening, and what will happen in the world around us. Physicists are not bookies, and physics is not the business of calculating odds. But Einstein could not deny that quantum mechanics was enormously successful in explaining and predicting, albeit in a statistical framework, experimental observations of the micro-world. And so, rather than attempting to show that quantum mechanics was wrong, a task that still looks like a fool's errand in light of its unparalleled successes, Einstein expended much effort on trying to show that quantum mechanics was not the final word on how the universe works. Even though he could not say what it was, Einstein wanted to convince everyone that there was a deeper and less bizarre description of the universe yet to be found. Over the course of many years, Einstein mounted a series of ever more sophisticated challenges aimed at revealing gaps in the structure of quantum mechanics. One such challenge, raised in 1927 at the fifth physical conference of the Solvay Institute, concerns the fact that even though an electron's probability wave might look like those mountain peaks piercing a layer of fog, whenever we measure the electron's whereabouts, we always find it at one definite position or another. So, Einstein asked, doesn't that mean that the probability wave is merely a temporary stand-in for a more precise description, one yet to be discovered, that would predict the electron's position with certainty? After all, if the electron is found at X, doesn't that mean in reality it was at or very near X a moment before the measurement was carried out? And if so, Einstein prodded, doesn't quantum mechanics' reliance on the probability wave, a wave that, in this example, says the electron had some probability to have been far from X, reflect the theory's inadequacy to describe the true underlying reality? Einstein's viewpoint is simple and compelling. What could be more natural than to expect a particle to be located at, or at the very least, near where it's found a moment later? If that's the case, a deeper understanding of physics should provide that information and dispense with the coarser framework of probabilities. But the Danish physicist Niels Bohr and his entourage of quantum mechanics defenders disagreed. Such reasoning, they argued, is rooted in conventional thinking, according to which each electron follows a single, definite path as it wanders to and fro. And this thinking is strongly challenged by the interference pattern resulting from electrons being fired through two slits. Since, if each electron did follow one definite path, like the classical image of a bullet fired from a gun, it would be extremely hard to explain the observed interference pattern. What would be interfering with what? Ordinary bullets fired one by one from a single gun certainly can't interfere with each other. So if electrons did travel like bullets, how would we explain their interference pattern? Instead, according to Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics he forcefully championed, before one measures the electron's position, there is no sense in even asking where it is. It does not have a definite position. The probability wave encodes the likelihood that the electron, when examined suitably, will be found here or there, and that truly is all that can be said about its position. Period. The electron has a definite position in the usual intuitive sense only at the moment we look at it, at the moment when we measure its position, identifying its location with certainty. But before and after we do that, all it has are potential positions described by a probability wave that, like any wave, is subject to interference effects. It's not that the electron has a position and that we don't know the position before we do our measurement. Rather, contrary to what you'd expect, the electron simply does not have a definite position before the measurement is taken. This is a radically strange reality. In this view, when we measure the electron's position, we are not measuring an objective, pre-existing feature of reality. Rather, the act of measurement is deeply enmeshed in creating the very reality it is measuring. Scaling this up from electrons to everyday life, Einstein quipped, "Do you really believe that the moon is not there unless we are looking at it?" The adherents of quantum mechanics responded with a version of the old saw about a tree falling in a forest. If no one is looking at the moon, if no one is measuring its location by seeing it, then there is no way for us to know whether it's there. So there is no point in asking the question. Einstein found this deeply unsatisfying. It was wildly at odds with his conception of reality. He firmly believed that the moon is there, whether or not anyone is looking. But the quantum stalwarts were unconvinced. Einstein's second challenge, raised at the Solvay conference in 1930, followed closely on the first. He described a hypothetical device which, through a clever combination of a scale, a clock, and a camera-like shutter, seemed to establish that a particle like an electron must have definite features, before it is measured or examined, that quantum mechanics said it couldn't. The details are not essential, but the resolution is particularly ironic. When Bohr learned of Einstein's challenge, he was knocked back on his heels. At first, he couldn't see a flaw in Einstein's argument. Yet, within days, he bounced back and fully refuted Einstein's claim. And the surprising thing is that the key to Bohr's response was general relativity. Bohr realized that Einstein had failed to take account of his own discovery that gravity warps time. that a clock ticks at a rate dependent on the gravitational field it experiences. When this complication was included, Einstein was forced to admit that his conclusions fell right in line with orthodox quantum theory. Even though his objections were shot down, Einstein remained deeply uncomfortable with quantum mechanics. In the following years, he kept Bohr and his colleagues on their toes, leveling one new challenge after another. His most potent and far-reaching attack focused on something known as the uncertainty principle, a direct consequence of quantum mechanics, enunciated in 1927 by Werner Heisenberg. Heisenberg and uncertainty. The uncertainty principle provides a sharp, quantitative measure of how tightly probability is woven into the fabric of a quantum universe. To understand it, think of the prefix menus in certain Chinese restaurants. Dishes are arranged in two columns, A and B. And if, for example, you order the first dish in column A, you are not allowed to order the first dish in column B. If you order the second dish in column A, you are not allowed to order the second dish in column B, and so forth. In this way, the restaurant has set up a dietary dualism, a culinary complementarity, one in particular that is designed to prevent you from piling up the most expensive dishes. On the prefix menu, you can have Peking duck or lobster Cantonese, but not both. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is similar. It says, roughly speaking, that the physical features of the microscopic realm, particle positions, velocities, energies, angular momenta, and so on, can be divided into two lists, A and B. And, as Heisenberg discovered, knowledge of the first feature from list A fundamentally compromises your ability to have knowledge about the first feature from list B. Knowledge of the second feature from list A fundamentally compromises your ability to have knowledge of the second feature from list B, and so on. Moreover, like being allowed a dish containing some Peking duck and some lobster Cantonese, but only in proportions that add up to the same total price, the more precise your knowledge of a feature from one list, the less precise your knowledge can possibly be about the corresponding feature from the second list. The fundamental inability to determine simultaneously all features from both lists, to determine with certainty all of these features of the microscopic realm, is the uncertainty revealed by Heisenberg's principle.